Well, I'm not on fall break. Are you guys? We're here. Let's do this. All right. I believe, and I get this from Scripture, and Adam just alluded to this, that we were created to create. That it's in our DNA as human beings to dream, to imagine, to risk, and to create. Really, even for those of us who we don't consider ourselves to be like artistic, creative in like the strict traditional, like the arts sense of that word, we saw last week that God is fundamentally a creator and that he's made us in his image, which means that we all have creative capacity, potential, even calling. It's in each one of us. And here's what we all know this. Creating is hard work, isn't it? It's hard work. Whether you're creating a work of art or you're launching a business, or you're coming up with a marketing campaign, or you're trying to come up with like a creative lesson plan to engage your students so they'll be inspired to learn, whether you're just trying to come up with something to cook for dinner using what you have in your house, creativity takes effort. And it actually requires something more than just effort, and it's that something more that I want to explore today. Genesis 1, we'll go back to the beginning here. Verse 27 says, "So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, 'Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground.'" Now this verse, particularly verse 28, sometimes theologians will call verse 28 the cultural mandate. That we were put here, A, to care for the world. It's in our DNA, it's by design that we're meant to care for creation. And then it says that we're to subdue, we're to rule over creation. And I realize that to us, subdue, rule, kind of has negative connotations to some of us, but the Hebrew idea is much more about care and stewardship and oversight of God's creation. But we're actually to do more than just the stewardship, conservationist side of this. Genesis says that we're created to fill the earth. In other words, to fill out what is actually only potentially there at creation. Filling the earth, increasing in number. That's more than just taking care of what's there, right? It's expanding on it. When people, by the way, when people reproduce, when people get big, they multiply, that raises all sorts of new possibilities. Those things unfold. They actually necessitate things like developing communication and language and how do we organize ourselves. So society building, even things like government. Genesis 2:15, it says, "The Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it." Now the word for work, this is actually the word cultivate. And we saw last week in Genesis 1, the emphasis is on God's creativity. And then therefore, our creativity, because we're made in his image. Genesis 2 is a parallel creation account, but in chapter 2, the emphasis is on cultivation. Actually, a few verses before this, think about this. The text mentions, "The gold of that land is good. Aromatic resin and onyx are also there." What? Really? Why mention precious metals and these resources, these things that you have to mine to even get to, let alone make any sense of or use? This is an invitation to discover, to understand, to engage the world around us. In other words, in Genesis 2, the garden is not just beautiful, it's actually kind of useful, kind of helpful. God's going, hey, just a hint, you might want to hang on to any gold you find because that'll come in handy later. This, by the way, means that science, the exploration, the understanding of the natural world, and in some ways the organizing it, the ordering of it, that is not intrinsically opposed to God. Because it kind of looks like that was his idea, that he invites that, in fact, from the beginning. And so God's command to cultivate, here's what I want us to see, it's not a command to sit around and do nothing. It implies that we will make something of creation, that we'll build on it, that we'll expand. Like God's going, I just want to see what you guys come up with. He gives us an invitation to use raw materials, to co-create with him, to fulfill untapped potential. Even before the fall, creation required tilling, keeping. We're given a capacity to create. We're not calling something out of nothing in quite the same way that God does, but we're called to reshape what exists into something genuinely new. And so the picture of humanity in Genesis is of creative cultivators. We are invited to create for the glory of God and also for the blessing, for the flourishing of humankind. Genesis 2 also has a kind of a remarkable scene that I think shows clearly that humanity's role in the garden at creation is anything but passive. Verse 19 says, "Now the Lord God had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them. And whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the man gave names to all the livestock, the birds in the sky, and all the wild animals." There is something absurd about God who formed this creature out of clay, breathed life into it, and then kind of parades all the animals and all the birds in front of Adam and says, "I want you to name them." You realize God probably knows that a giraffe is a giraffe, right? He doesn't need humanity's help to name all the animals and the birds. And here you have whatever the man called each living creature, and here the writer kind of shrugs his shoulders a little bit. Well, that was his name. Yeah. When my kids, we got these kittens recently, and they were naming them. And even in that small instance, I felt like I kind of had to step in and to steer the decision. You know, Pinky Princess, that's a lovely name. Let's just put that on the table, though, for the time being. So God is perfectly capable of naming every animal and then giving Adam a dictionary. But that's not what he does. He makes room for Adam's creativity. In other words, he genuinely allows Adam the space to speak something out of nothing, a name where before there was no name, and then to allow that name to have its own being. And God simply watches and listens, and it is good. Now, even the fall into sin in Genesis 3 does not destroy our human responsibility to co-create with God. Sin corrupts these gifts that God has given us, but it has not undone them. We're still called to create. And yes, we now need God's help to fix our broken world. It's the story of redemption in Jesus and our ultimate hope that God will renew this world. But even in Genesis 4, we see all kinds of new cultural initiatives. If you look at Genesis 4 sometime, there's musicianship, there's urban development, there's tent making, even metalworking. We are hardwired to create. So the question after the fall is, what kind of world are we going to make? This brings us to the concept of culture, which, according to sociologists, is very complex. The literary critic Terry Eagleton, he says that culture is the second most complicated word in the English language, after the word nature. And I just want to say I am borrowing here shamelessly from Andy Crouch's book, Culture Making. And in it, he quotes Christian cultural critic, Sally Sells Seashores, but Ken Myers, he says this: we need a definition of culture. Culture is what we make of the world. It's the name for our relentless, restless human effort to take what we're given and to make something else. Now, I think most of us think of culture as kind of an idea. It's like an interior state or it's a concept that's abstract, kind of floating out there somewhere. That, or we think of culture as reserved for the arts, music, literature, fashion, trends, fads, those kinds of things. Or we'll think of pop culture or high culture or culture wars, you know, in politics. Those are all parts of culture, but the reality is it's vast, isn't it? That's why it's complicated. It's plural. There are many layers to our culture. But here's the thing you have to understand. More than anything else, culture involves tangible goods. It's tangible goods, the things that a people makes. Culture is concrete, which means that culture is its language, its institutions, its government, it's the food you eat, it's the clothes you wear, it's the car you drive, the music you listen to, the organization you get your paycheck from, the school that your kids go to. All of these are tangible manifestations of culture. These are examples of what we make with the world. Everything from shoes to barbecue chicken pizza to neckties, that's a weird one, to civic organizations to even churches. These are cultural goods that people make, and they're tangible. And that's really important because, again, many of us think of culture as something floating around somewhere else. It's tangible. Concepts are a part of culture when they become fleshed out tangibly. The concept of justice, which is important to all of us, that doesn't actually become a cultural reality until it shows up in concrete ways, like written laws and law enforcement officials that you can see, and courts and prisons and these kinds of things. Then it becomes a cultural reality. Is everyone with me? All right. All I'm saying is we don't make culture. We make bread. Okay? We build hospitals. We tell stories. We pass laws. And in that sense, we make culture. These become the artifacts, sociologists or anthropologists will say. It doesn't mean they're old. It just means they're tangible goods of our culture. And then over time, these things build and they grow and they become this huge framework that not only is the air that we breathe, but it's the structure, it's the framework we pass on to the next generation. Now, culture isn't just what we make of the world in the obvious sense of buildings and highways and skyscrapers and universities and reality TV and MacBooks. It's also what we make of the world in the deeper sense. Whenever you find yourself kind of puzzled by a scene in a movie or by lyrics in a song, you're like, what was that? We turn to a friend and we say, what do you make of that? We're not asking our friend to write a new scene. We're not asking them to sing new lyrics. We're asking them to make sense. What sense do you make of this? And it's in this deeper sense. We're asking for interpretation. We are born into a world that clearly needs some interpreting. We find ourselves in the middle of the world that cries out for explanation. And it's this deeper sense that of culture, this is what makes us different from like the rest of creation. Ants and birds and monkeys, they all make stuff, right? They essentially reshape their environment. And some even use, you know, nests and ant hills, and some even use rudimentary tools and techniques. But there's no indication that any other creature ever wonders about the mystery of the world. So making sense of the world is left up to human beings alone. Culture is what we make of the world. It's also how we make sense of the world. We make sense of it by making. By the way, this explains our fascination with apocalyptic movies. So you have like zombie apocalypse and global warming apocalypse and nuclear apocalypse and viral apocalypse, which usually goes back to zombie apocalypse. In these movies, there's a cataclysmic event that undoes all of culture, that hits the reset button. Everything that, you know, schools and roads and systems and all that stuff goes away, and we're back to chaos and we're back to anarchy. And the question is, how will the survivors make meaning? How will they create new culture with the memories and the remnants and the new realities? And so culture is what we make of the world, and the goods, the artifacts that we make actually help us have meaning. It's complicated, like I said. If you're confused about what culture is, think about zombie apocalypse, okay? Everything that goes away, all the ways that the world is affected, those are all tangible parts of culture. That's what it is. So all that to say, along come Christians, believers, the church, into this pre-existing, multi-layered, pluralistic culture. All these things, these ways of making meaning that are long existing and also evolving around us, and these goods, these artifacts around us. And the Christian believes there's a deeper story. There's a deeper meaning. And so we believe in the good news. We believe in the gospel, the way of life that Jesus embodies that and surprises us that there are our assumptions about the world are overturned. And so we come along and we want to communicate this reality to other people of God, of redemption, of hope. We say, hey, there's more to life than just pursuing cultural artifacts of status. Houses, cars, toys, etc. There's more to life than just pursuing fame or power. And so while there are things in our culture that are good, there are also things in our culture that go against God, against this deeper story. And so we find that there are ways that we believe our culture needs to change. But again, culture is complicated. There are a lot of layers. And so we also discover that, boy, to communicate that, we have to get through a lot of cultural noise, because otherwise we're not heard. And so in order to be heard, we end up taking on various postures toward culture. And Crouch outlines four of these. I want to summarize these, but it's really building on older works. And the point here is this. These four postures that we take to culture, in response to culture, they don't actually work. They produce almost zero change. The first response, the first posture toward culture is to condemn it. Right? The world has changed a lot in the past 100 years. Particularly since the first half of the 20th century, Christians have lost a significant deal of their status, our status in this country. Used to be we had more seats of power in government and, you know, in prestigious universities. Think about the Ivy League schools 100 years ago, 200 years ago. What were they initially? Seminaries. But that's changed, hasn't it? And I'm not just talking Harvard and Princeton. You have Christian organizations like the YMCA, Young Men's Christian Association, and YWCA. They're still doing great work, but if you look at what they were doing in like the 20s and what they're doing now, it's a bit of a shift in focus, if I could say that. Which, by the way, means that we're actually influenced more by culture than we will admit. We try to change it, but in fact, it's changing us all the time. The world has changed. As Christians, we started, you know, especially in the last century, the first half of the 1900s, for the first time since Constantine, we found ourselves on the margins of power and influence to some degree. And our response then was to try to beat culture. We got to keep it like it used to be. And so you think about the fundamentalist preacher rallying against the latest cultural trend or innovation and then encouraging his congregation to kind of withdraw into a sanctified, safe world of fellow believers. Of course, the fundamentalists didn't condemn sturdy church buildings. They didn't condemn the use of radio or print materials. They didn't condemn modest clothing, which are all cultural goods. The assumption was that you could withdraw from culture, that it was separate. We can stand out here and critique, and it's separate from us. You can't withdraw from culture unless you wander naked in the rainforest, which has been attempted, but not by the fundamentalists. The Amish, that was funnier than I thought. The Amish, to think about. The Amish tried this, and they didn't even withdraw from culture. All they did was import, like, 19th, 18th century German culture into the present. It's another culture just imported into ours, but it's still very much a culture. So over the past several decades, we've seen a withdrawal from Christians, from different spheres that we've rejected or condemned. Columnist David Brooks observes, evangelical Christians are practically absent from entire professions such as academia, the media, and filmmaking. Holiness became associated with negative choices, right? The avoidance of cultural activities like dancing or going to the movies. There were all kinds of sermons about the dangers of the world, and anything that could not be explicitly justified on biblical grounds. Very few sermons in this era were preached on the delights of the world. We limit our cultural engagement to clever church signs. We think it's going to make a difference. This is a posture of digging in, isn't it? While the world, by the way, moves right on without even blinking. If all we ever do is condemn culture, especially if we're just talking to ourselves, mutually agreeing on how bad things are getting, we have almost zero chance of having any cultural effect, because human nature resists a vacuum. Not very many people will give something up just because someone else condemns it. They need something better, or the current set of cultural goods is going to do. I mean, you think about the movie industry. There's a long chain that stretches from writers and actors, directors, producers, distributors, to movie theaters, to finally people who show up to see a movie. That system is designed, every link of that chain, to keep the cycle of production and distribution and consumption going. And so let's say you didn't like what was being shown at the theater on a given weekend. It does not matter how much you protest. Unless you offer an alternative, the show will go on and on and on. Barbara Nicolosi, who's a screenwriter, also a Christian leader in Hollywood, she reminds us, any publicity is good publicity. Protests not only fuel the box office, they make Christians look like idiots. Hey. The second posture is we can critique it. This came along later. Christians after World War II thought, is there another way between rallying against culture, railing against it, and blindly joining in? In other words, what if we were more subtle with this? What if we didn't condemn movies and music and art outright? Instead, we analyze them, critiquing them to show how they're inadequate or maybe misguided. Maybe we can even recognize that some movies have redeeming qualities. And don't even get me started on Christian pastors' obsession with films like The Matrix and so on. But we spend all kinds of energy adding up the moments when they get it right. In the posture of critique, we don't condemn culture. We analyze it. We look at its worldview. We use culture to raise philosophical questions about our time and maybe even to persuade people of the truth of the gospel. This leads to pretty sophisticated analysis of the goods on offer in our culture. The depressing thing about this approach is that critique and analysis alone very rarely change culture. To engage culture, that's the motto of the critiquers. To engage culture is kind of like just thinking about it, right? Just thinking, thoughts, talking about it. The assumption is that action would follow from this reflection and lead to transformation. But analysis alone, understanding alone, doesn't lead to transformation. It's why for several decades, Hollywood's profits have been driven by blockbusters, by formulaic sequels. Anyone know what I'm talking about? And those always pretty much get trashed on by respected critics. And you notice it doesn't really matter what they say, the critics. It doesn't matter how critical they are, or even how positive they are. It has very little effect on the success or failure. Year after year, summer blockbusters break records. Because instead, theaters are swamped by the word-of-mouth endorsements of ordinary people just looking for some entertainment on a Friday night. The third option is to copy culture. What if we imitate it, replacing offensive parts with more suitable ones? Hollywood is godless. Let's create our own kind of film industry with actors and producers and directors and all that kind of thing, and a parallel industry without the problems in the mainstream Hollywood. And it's true that the new movies in a parallel film industry would be cultural goods. You can watch them, but they're limited. Because if they're never shown in mainstream theaters, if they are created and consumed entirely by a particular subculture, they have no influence at all on the mainstream. For the rest of the world, it's as if that piece of culture, no matter how excellent, no matter how significant it might be, it's as if it never existed. Imitative culture provides perhaps a safe haven from the mainstream. But for the people who never encountered it, they're going to go to the movies like they always have. Culture at large remains unchanged when we just copy culture. The Jesus movement in the 1960s and the 70s did this with music. They let go of traditional expressions of church, of Christianity. It's why I'm wearing jeans in church right now. So thank you, Jesus movement. I mean, the idea of a worship band, which seems normal to us, you can't imagine how adamantly conventional churches resisted, you know, young people's long hair, Cliff, or especially electric guitars and drums. But it's interesting because the gap between church culture and wider culture, that gap was actually hopelessly large already, long before the Jesus movement came along and kind of forced the issue. For decades, church music had remained classical-ish, right? That was during, throughout whole decades where we had some of the most creative periods in American popular music, from swing to jazz to finally rock and roll. And so long before the first Christian rocker ever played a power chord, we were cut off as Christians from the primary musical language of our culture. But back to the Jesus movement. Because why should the devil have all the good music, right? Huh? Actually, I think Martin Luther said that, but that doesn't sound like him. Christian rockers couldn't deny that the lifestyle or the lyrics of rock and roll, that's incompatible with Christianity. But they came up with one simple solution: change the content while keeping the form. Change the content, adopt the form. And so over the 70s, this little movement grew and grew and grew into this huge industry called CCM, Contemporary Christian Music. And it was a huge turning point in the shaping of evangelicalism as we know it today. There was no movement of Christians in the 20th century before this. No movement had so shamelessly borrowed from the mainstream. Christians were now no longer rowing against the wind like the condemners, right? We're not just kind of side to side like the critiquers. It is full on, downwind, here we go. Christian music producers and artists, they found a way to basically fit Jesus into any cultural form that was climbing the charts. The problem comes when you realize you got to make something for it to be culture. Here's the other piece of this. It has to be consumed by a public, or it's not culture. And so the problem is, it's only going to impact the culture that it reaches, the people that it reaches. If Christians were the only public this copycat culture reached, then it made very little impact on a much broader culture who wasn't interested in that, and to be honest, had no clue it was even happening in the first place. The last posture that doesn't work in changing culture is to just consume. What if we got enough people together who decided to vote with their dollars to convince Hollywood to make a different kind of movie? When the Da Vinci Code, remember that movie? It's kind of controversial. You've heard of it. When that came out, there were Christians who said, let's go to the movies on the opening weekend of the Da Vinci Code. We know boycotts, that doesn't work because the movie just goes on. Let's go and see something else on the opening weekend and vote with our dollars. And there's marginal effect that has some effect, but it's not very big. Put it this way, you know how when the weather's really good, the opening of a movie actually suffers? Like the box office takes a hit? And so, and there are stats for this, like a high pressure system in the Midwest can actually affect a movie opening, their bottom line, it can affect it by like 10%, which so far has been more than any group of people have been able to do in trying to rally and vote with our dollars. So, and here's why. We live in a globalized culture, don't we? Even large groups of consumers very rarely can consume their way into cultural change. We're up against the combined decisions of millions and millions of other purchasers. Consumption, according to Andy Crouch, this is now the dominant posture among self-described evangelicals today toward culture. Not condemnation, not critique, not imitation, consumption. The fundamentalist said, don't go to the movies, they're evil. The evangelical said, go to the movies, but just examine their worldview. Copiers, the Jesus movement said, go to Christian films, which retell the gospel message using, you know, cinematic form. Very few Christians today forbid going to the movies. And we don't engage in a whole lot of critique of the films we see. And there are some attempts to make our own. But most of the time, you know what we do? We go to the movies. And in the words of, the immortal words of Keanu Reeves, just go, whoa, right? Oh. We walk out of the theater and we're distracted and we're amused, just like our fellow, you know, Americans, our other people around us who don't share our faith. We're content to be just like our fellow Americans. Maybe, if we're honest, we're actually driven by a lingering sense of shame and embarrassment about our uncool forebears. And so maybe, if we're honest, we actually want to be slightly more like our fellow Americans than anybody else. So what's the answer? Whew. Andy Crouch says the only way to change culture is to create more of it. These postures have all been attempted. And by the way, there are groups, and I could name names, of people today still assuming all four of these postures. It's not like clean categories. They're all still going on. But creativity is the only viable source of cultural change, because culture is the accumulation of tangible things, the stuff we make of the world. And I think we miss this when we talk sometimes about culture being this vague thing, like the comparison between human beings in culture and like fish in water, and because the fish is in it, we assume the fish is unaware of the water then. Of course, culture can have effects on us because it's all around us. It can affect us in ways that we're not aware of, but culture is something that presents itself to us. It's something that we can see, touch, hear, taste, and smell. It presents itself to our five senses, or it's not culture. If culture is going to change, it's because some new tangible good is presented to a wide enough public that it begins to reshape the world. The philosopher Albert Borgman, he said this: human cultures have the strange property of always being full. Think about this. No culture experiences its own culture as thin or incomplete. It always expands to fill all the space. Culture is always full. We need culture too much. Language, food, clothing, stories, art. We can't stand the absence of it. I mean, think about language. There is no language that, to its speaker, lacks the capacity to say everything they experience, to communicate. Think about colors. Languages actually break up the color spectrum very, very differently. But every language has a name for every color its speaker can see. There aren't people waiting around for someone to finally invent the word so we can talk about yellow, right? Culture fills in all the space available. It means that change will happen only when something new contends in this space. And as Christians, we've been contending in a filled out cultural space since the beginning. Something new has to come along and essentially displace something else. A new alternative has to be offered tangibly. You guys, you were perfectly content with your flip phone. Perfectly content. Until what? Like smartphone, iPhones, right. And then all of a sudden, you weren't content with that anymore. I still have a flip phone, by the way. Me and Andrew Luck, so we're holding out. If you want to change culture, we have to create something new that will persuade our neighbors to set aside current cultural goods in exchange for something else. Now, Crouch talks about the difference between postures and gestures, and this is important. Your posture is your learned but unconscious default position. It's how your body is when you're not really aware of it, when you're not thinking about it. Our posture is very hard for us to see, right? It's why, you know, my parents were always saying, you're slouching, Matt, all the time when I was a teenager. I wasn't aware of that. Gestures, though, these are movements that we make throughout the day based on what the circumstance requires. And so we might bend down to pick something off the floor. We might curl up to read a book. We might tense up if you have to slam on the brakes and do the arm seat belt, you know, for your passenger. Does anybody else do that besides me? What's wrong with us? These four postures, as postures, don't change culture as default postures. But there are times when these are all appropriate gestures. There are some cultural goods, artifacts, that can only be condemned. You think of the global sex trade with its web of violence and corruption, all these things. There is only one thing to do with that. Condemn it outright. Reject it. Or take ISIS. Right? There are some things that just deserve condemnation. Pornography. Economic systems that are dependent on factories in far-off countries where workers are exploited and all but or actually enslaved. That needs to stop. Some parts of culture deserve to be critiqued. We do critique. Maybe the best example of this is like the fine arts. I mean, art is an invitation to discuss. It's presenting an idea or an ideal. It's kind of raising awareness about our current cultural moment or making us see the world in a new way. And so the appropriate thing to do with art as Christians, we're humans, is to critique it. In fact, the better the art, the more it pushes us to critique. If you saw, you know, whatever, Transformers came out this summer, blockbuster, big deal, I think. And that's great. It's escapism, it's fun, it's enjoyment, it's entertainment. But chances are you walk out of those kinds of experiences and you don't really talk about it at all. It doesn't invite much critique. But you see the movie, the film, The Tree of Life. I can talk longer about that movie than the movie itself even is, when it's a long movie. At the same time, other gestures toward art don't really make any sense. You can't really consume art. You can't possess it like that. You can't slot it away unthinkingly in your daily life. It's difficult to copy great art, and illegal, essentially, as well. you know, and of all the postures toward culture, to condemn it, particularly with art, almost always ends up sounding shrill, doesn't it? Kind of silly. It's hard to think of an example where someone condemned art and that did not, in fact, result in heightened notoriety for the art and the artist. Copying has a place. Borrowing from mainstream culture, infusing it with Christian content. Because when we set out to communicate or live the gospel, we never start out from scratch. Even builders of church buildings, before church buildings were indistinguishable from warehouses, even back then, Christian architects borrowed from secular architects in the building and the construction. Church musicians, long before modern culture sort of developed the uncanny ability to echo anything in mainstream culture, you have people like Bach and the Wesleys borrowing from the culture, taking the tunes and reworking them for church liturgical use. There are things in our culture where the most appropriate response is to consume. I'm thinking of sushi in particular. Or take a freshly baked loaf of bread. I don't condemn that as a distraction from spiritual things. I don't also probe it for its assumptions about the world. I eat. I enjoy, because it's going to be stale, you know, tomorrow. The problem is when these gestures become postures, when they become our default fixed stance toward culture. There's a whole lot to condemn, but that problem with making it our stance is it closes us off to the grace and the mercy available in many forms of culture. It also makes us hypocrites, by the way, as a default posture, because we're hardly free of culture ourselves. And sometimes the things that Christians, the things we condemn and denounce in the world, they're just as dreadful as the things that are going on among us and in us are just as dreadful as the things we critique and criticize and complain about in the secular culture. Something our neighbors actually notice just fine. This leaves us condemning culture as a posture with nothing to offer. Even if we do manage someone, we persuade them to give up a current cultural good. For what? For what? You've got to have something else. The same is true for critiquing as a posture. It makes us kind of passive. What other good thing is the culture going to give us for us to think about and talk about and generate buzz about? It also leaves us unable to just enjoy sometimes our culture because we got to interrogate it. What's its worldview? What's its presuppositions? The posture of critique, it tempts us toward the academic fallacy that says that once I understand and analyze something, I've changed it. That's actually not true. There actually has to be something else. There has to be action for it to be changed. Copying culture can be a fine gesture. It's just a very poor posture. It's good to honor the good things in our culture and even incorporate them in the Christian community. But when we make that our posture, there's a whole swarm of things that are unwanted that follow. We end up becoming passive, kind of like the critics. We're waiting to see what cultural good will be served up next for us to imitate, co-opt, and annex ourselves. And in areas where culture changes really quickly, this means that we end up finding ourselves constantly slightly behind the times. And the things that we do imitate, the things that we copy, imitation reduces the complex to the simple, by definition. It's a kind of caricature of the original. And so our copies end up sanding off the rough and the surprising edges of the original thing, and then we wonder why it seems a little flat, why it doesn't quite resonate. This contains the same active ingredient as how inspiring, right? And really the greatest danger of copying as a posture is that we're too successful, that we actually end up creating a whole subculture beneath culture, and it's like having a private highway that you can only drive on, you know, cars with fish emblems only. We end up never encountering the broader world that we're imitating. And so if all we ever do is copy culture for our own Christian ends, that's a failure to love and serve our neighbor. And then consumption. As a posture, it's the one that we drift into most naturally. It's letting the culture set the terms. It's letting the it's thinking, I believe the culture knows my deepest longings and my deepest fears and has some solution for both of those things if only I can afford to buy it. I wonder what Christians are known for in the world outside our churches. Are we known as condemners, critiquers, copiers, consumers? I'm afraid so. Why aren't we known as cultivators? As people who tend and nourish what is best in culture, as people who do the hard work to preserve the best of what's been made, what people before us have done. Why aren't we known as creators? People who create something that makes the world a more welcoming and thrilling and beautiful place. It's in our book, like page one. According to Genesis 1 and 2, the picture of God that we find there. We're most like God when we create good things. It explains why, you know, when somebody does something truly creative, genuinely creative, and it's good work, we use language of inspiration. We say that inspires us. Inspiration, to inspire means to breathe into, to breathe life into, which is what God does for us as humans at creation. He breathes into us, and it's what we do when we create and we inspire other people. It's what we do for people around us. All right, here's the application, because I know you're waiting for that. In order for us to be good creators, to make things that are compelling and beautiful and impact our culture, here's the thing. We first have to be good cultivators. Culture is what we make of the world, and it's cumulative, and it was here first. We have to learn to cultivate first. You never make culture from scratch. You're building on what's been done before, what previous generations have handed on to us. When you go to the kitchen to cook dinner, when a screenwriter sits down to write a script, the first requirement is that we will be acquainted with that cultural world. To cook well, you have to be familiar with knives and the qualities of spices and the properties of cast iron pots. You got to understand, are you making, you know, Italian food or Mexican food? You got to understand something about the tradition you're working in. In the same way, the screenwriter has to understand Western visual storytelling, the history of the novel and the development of genre and the act structure in the movie Chinatown. They have to understand, Final Draft, the software in detail and the 54 lines per page standard thing. And they got to know words like beat and sequence and act and all these things. When it comes to creativity, naivete is not a virtue. And that's a very important distinction. Sometimes people think, well, I got this passion, I'm just gonna work hard. But if you're naive, that's actually not a virtue. The more each one of us knows about our cultural domain, arena, whether it's about learning styles for the teacher, or business practices, leadership concepts for the entrepreneur, the more we know about those things, the more likely we are to create something new and worthwhile. I don't know if you've heard of the abstract expressionist Makoto Fujimura, also a Christian. Look him up sometime. His work is really, really cool. But he points this out, that when art students try to imitate Jackson Pollock's like seemingly childish splatters and drips, like anybody can do that. That looks easy. He says it never actually works. It doesn't even come close to comparing. Makoto says that Pollock's work wouldn't be great painting without, and this is apparent to Makoto, without the tradition that he was trained and shaped by, which is apparent even to Makoto in his work. Cultivation, or rather creation, begins with careful cultivation, taking care of the good things our culture's already handed us. See, for us as Christians, our first response is to, I want to change culture. That's not the first response. It shouldn't be. Our first responsibility, no matter what field or arena you find yourself in, our first responsibility is not to make something new, but to become fluent in the tradition that's been handed to us, that we're responsible to. You know what that takes? Humility, respect. Before we can become makers of culture, before we can change culture, we have to keep it. We have to honor it. We have to learn the culture that we're born into and immersed by. This is why human beings take longer to fully develop than any other creature. This is a complex process to learn all of this. People often think about kids as innately creative and imaginative, and they are. But we look at them, and because they lack self-censoring, self-awareness that plagues us, it's like, I wish I could just be like that. And I'm just saying this. Kids do express their creativity, their desire to make something new from an early age, but most of the time what kids are doing is not creating. You know what they're doing? They're imitating. They're learning language. They're learning the stories and the symbols and the sayings of our culture. They're learning the meaning of street signs and stoplights. They're learning the rules of baseball. They're learning, like I tried to teach my kids recently, what the word literally means. That's a hard one to explain to a five-year-old. They're learning all of these things. They're not necessarily creating anything or new or making culture. They're imitating. Just like you have to master a language if you're going to write well in it, kids have to become culturally fluent if they're going to grow up and contribute something meaningful to the cultural landscape. It's why parents will praise a kid for their painting and even hang it on the fridge. Very rarely does that masterpiece change the world, right? Because they're not ready yet, because they're still cultivating. Mozart, a prodigy, composing since he was like, one or whatever. He actually did not compose his greatest works until he was in his 30s, just a few years before he died at 35. Cultivating sounds like work, and it is. But we only create where we've learned to cultivate. You know the domains that sound most creative, like music and art? They actually have some of the most intense disciplines, don't they? You've got to practice and you've got to, the fundamentals and the scales and all these things that kids hate because I just want to play real music. It's a requirement, though, to get the coordination to play a new song or an old one well. Musicians work through basics of their instruments. Professionals do for half an hour or more daily. Chefs practice their knife work. Doctors read through medical journals. These are examples of keeping culture. And what happens for us is we see someone who creates something and we're inspired by that thing that they create, and we fail to recognize that underneath that are countless acts of cultivation. The good screenwriter has first watched 1,000 films. The surgeon who comes up with a new technique has first performed 1,000 routine surgeries. The investor who funds the next startup has first studied 1,000 balance sheets and business proposals. Cultural creativity requires maturity, fluency, hard work, cultivation. Michelangelo said, if people knew how hard I worked to get my mastery, it wouldn't seem so wonderful at all. That sounds kind of negative, but I get what he's saying. People just look at this thing, but there's cultivation, years of it to create well. A couple questions, and then we're done. What's your dominant posture toward culture? Is it to condemn, to critique, to copy, consume? Or is it to create? In what sphere of culture have you been called and gifted to create? Where are you supposed to bring the gifts and capacities that God has given you to bear for the glory of God, the blessing of humankind? Maybe it's the arts, maybe it's business, marketing, education, media, athletics, organizational leadership, civic organizations, government, on and on. And then the last question, and maybe the most important one, what are you doing to cultivate deeply where you are? Are you engaged in the discipline of cultivation? that all true creative work, all lasting, impactful creative work requires. Everyone wants to change the world. Some people are willing to work hard. Very, very few people possess the discipline and the humility to first cultivate deeply. Would you stand with me? We'll pray. Lord, again, we are reminded of the creative capacity and potential you put in us. You've hardwired us to create. Lord, we know that there's so much potential to inspire people, to inspire change in our culture, the things that aren't good, that aren't honoring for you. I just pray that you would give each one of us a sense of direction. Lord, what are the gifts, what are the passions that you put in our hearts that we need to stir up a little bit? Lord, help us to be willing to do the work of cultivation. That in humility, we would cultivate, we would have the discipline needed so that we could come to a place where we might have something to say. We might have something genuine and beautiful and creative to offer. Lord, help us to work for your glory, for the flourishing of humanity. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thanks for letting me run over just a little bit there. Have a great week. Grace and peace be with you. Go with God. We'll see you next week.